This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer Scott Spencer, who's best known for his critically acclaimed novel, Endless Love. The film adaptation of Endless Love, which starred Brooke Shields, took this story of emotional extremes and made it into what one critic described as a teen makeout movie. Many people who were introduced to Endless Love by the movie were unprepared for Spencer's depth, virtuosity, and sense of humor. His novel, Endless Love, is written from the perspective of a 28-year-old man remembering how his life was ruled by his obsession with his first love when he was 17, and how through acting on his desire, he lost everything that mattered to him in the world, including his lover. Spencer sustains a fevered lyricism throughout the book, which was nominated for an American Book Award. Spencer was disappointed in the movie adaptation, but he loves films and has written several screenplays, including Split Image and Act of Vengeance. Scott Spencer's latest novel, Waking the Dead, like his previous novels, Endless Love and Preservation Hall, deals with obsession, moral confusion, and the struggle to maintain a tenuous hold on sanity. The story of Waking the Dead is about a 34-year-old lawyer named Fielding Pierce who thinks he's about to fulfill his destiny by running for U.S. Congress in Chicago. As he enters the political arena, his heart and mind are taken over by a vision that his lover is still alive. But he knows that she was killed in a car bombing while she was transporting Chilean refugees to a church for sanctuary. Waking the Dead is published by Knopf. I asked Scott Spencer to read an excerpt from it. He began with the opening paragraph.
Sarah Williams left for Minneapolis with our life together in the worst possible repair. I knew enough about the suddenness of things to know that you ought never say goodbye to someone you love without acknowledging that you might be looking at them for the very last time. I broke this emotional law, and 26 hours later, Sarah was pronounced dead and zippered up in a black rubber bag in Minneapolis Community General Hospital. And what has happened to Sarah is that in the midst of helping Chilean refugees find a sanctuary in a local church in Minneapolis, St. Paul, she's in a car that is destroyed in a radio-detonated car bomb. And Fielding hears about this on the national TV news and rushes to Minneapolis and is thrust into the confusion of that horror. And then we pick him up again when he and Sarah's father are on their way down to New Orleans with Sarah's body. I sat next to Sarah's father on the flight to New Orleans. Neither of us wanted the company of the other, but there was no way around it. His name was Eugene, named after his father. He sold insurance and acted as if this gave him a certain insight and competence in matters of life and death, as if he were a surgeon or a priest. He was successful, but not well-liked. Sarah was one of his three children, all daughters. He'd named her Sarah, S-A-R-A, thinking it was ladylike, fetching. She'd added the H to her name later on. They had argued about everything. She was the family outcast, and his love for her was not at all abiding. Sarah's mother's name was Dorothy, and she was afraid and evasive around Eugene. It was hard to say where her loyalties were. She seemed mostly to care about appearances, and even though it's probably an emotional impossibility to care only for the surface of life, Dorothy seemed to do so. Eugene and I watched the stewardess demonstrate the safety features of the 727. It was a rough takeoff, right into the wind, and it surprised me how fervently I wanted the plane to crash. Clouds raced past like torn, dirty rags. You could hear the engines straining. Then the no-smoking sign went off with a little ping, and we were securely airborne. Eugene lit up a cool and tilted his seat back. He tied off his white loafers and exhaled smoke through his nose. Sarah's body was in the belly of the plane. Minneapolis was beneath us, looking clean, ordinary, distant. Then it curved away, as if the earth in its rotation suddenly jerked forward, and beneath us was the frozen stubble of farmland and the little blue enameled bumps, the silos. We were flying. We were going to heaven. When the stewardess came by, Eugene asked her for a vodka and tonic. They weren't serving drinks yet, but she seemed to know he was the father of the woman, the body, below. She seemed also to know who I was, and she asked if I wanted something as well. I said no, just because it was easier. When his drink arrived, Eugene took a bottle of pills from his jacket and shook one out into his hand. He had a large palm, and the lines in it had a faint reddish tinge. "Want one?" I shrugged. "What are you taking?" "Dorothy's doctor gave me some tranquilizers, and I'm taking them," he said. He smiled, as if there was some tragic irony in a man of his enormous strength having to take a woman's medicine. "Are they doing any good?" I asked. "I think so. I'm not so jumpy, you know." I put my hand out, and he gave me one. It was the same light blue as Eugene's suit on one half and dark brown on the other. I put it in my pocket. "I'll keep it for later." The word "later" had a bad effect on me. Time was moving on, but it was empty now. The word "later" made me realize that my life might be very, very long, and that now I would have to live every second of it without her.
I really love the way you write. My guest is Scott Spencer, and that's an excerpt of his new novel, Waking the Dead. Your stories seem to me, and the narrative seems to me to be about obsession, to be obsessed with obsession and with lost love, with a love that you can never get back because she's gone from you forever or she's dead. Why are you that interested in obsession and in those kinds of extremes?
I have to answer this in a slightly roundabout way. I've never really used the word obsession. It's a word that seems to be used about me an awful lot, and it's you know, in otherwise brilliant articles about me, the word obsession seems to crop up. By my lights, we say obsession or almost as a way of giving a psychiatric label to a certain pitch of feeling, and we keep those who are capable of that pitch of feeling at arm's length from us by saying, that's obsession. That lets us off the hook from having to wonder why we aren't acting with that kind of heedless emotional bravery. But, you know, with that petty quibble out of the way, I am attracted to characters who proceed without any emotional accountancy, who don't figure the profit and loss of an action, but just follow an instinct. I find that, you know, an attractive quality in people and in fiction. I think it offers a lot of possibilities.
After having read three of your novels, I've been really wanting to know if you've ever experienced the kind of separation and loss that your characters have.
I'm lucky enough to have met the woman who I feel most, you know, cosmically attached to, and not only stayed with her, but married her and had children with her.
The main characters in your book all have very interesting parents, and in a couple of the books, the parents are very neurotic and are also former communists or socialists, but they're communists or socialists who have become assimilated into the middle class and have a lot of kind of typically American middle class neuroses. Do you see children as having to like survive their parents' neuroses? Do you think that those neuroses get passed on?
Sure. I mean, you know, even our pets pick up our neuroses. So how are our children going to escape from them? But I think that it's something else that's passed on, that's trickier than neuroses, and that's the hidden agenda of one's parents and the lives that your parents didn't get to lead that are unconsciously handed over to you to fulfill. And I think that's the real interesting stuff that gets passed between parents and children.
I'm going to ask you to do one more short reading.
Sure.
And this is from your new book, Waking the Dead, and this is a sequence about the main character's parents.
Right. This is he sees them. They come down basically out of enormous loyalty to New Orleans to be with him before Sarah is buried. And coming with his parents are his sister Carolyn and his brother Danny, and they're remembering what it was like to be raised in Brooklyn by their parents. We stayed up late talking. I remember laughing. I remember Carolyn recalling the tricky little current events quizzes Mom forced us to take over breakfast. What kind of plane was Captain Jerry Powers flying on his mission over Russia when the Soviets shot him down? Answer, a U-2. Right? But wrong, silly. His name isn't Jerry, it's Gary. Like fanatical gardeners working in soil of questionable fertility, our parents slaved over us with a kind of diligence that certainly included love, but was not confined to it. And now, here we were, the three of us, bound together not only by the normal genetic magic of siblings, but by the sort of loopy heroic narrative that binds veterans of a long war. Veterans of the Asian Wars wear those satin jackets that say on the back, "I know I'm going to heaven because I've spent my time in hell," and then they have a drawing of Korea or Vietnam. Danny had wanted us to wear jackets that said the same thing, but with a picture of our genteel, shabby brownstone in Brooklyn instead.
Your parents were active socialists or communists?
Yeah, my parents were quite active in the 30s and 40s.
You were politically active when you were a teenager, right?
Yes, and beyond.
And beyond, okay. But when you were a teenager, you were, I think, the executive secretary of the Illinois Socialist Party.
Yes.
for a while.
Yes. You have my dossier.
That's right. We have your files. I prepare for interviews by sending to the Freedom of Information
That's
Act.
Great. I'm so glad that they recognized me.
Now, was that part of your parents' influence, becoming active in that?
I think it must have been part of their unconscious influence, although... What really drove me into the Socialist Party, I shouldn't say drove me, led me to the Socialist Party, was reading a poem by Allen Ginsberg, was reading Kaddish. And he has a line describing his mother hitchhiking through Pennsylvania with the Young People's Socialist League. And I'd never heard of such an organization. And I felt at that time in my life very trapped in a banal existence, and I didn't know anybody who was interested in anything that I was interested in. I didn't know people who read books and who was, you know, who had my sort of incoherent feelings of rebellion, and that somewhere out there was a Young People's Socialist League just seemed to be a deliverance to me, and I wrote away to them and said that I wanted to join, and next thing I knew I was in it.
When you left the Socialist, did you stay political, or did you become a young literati then and team up with all the people in the English department?
Well, I think that a couple of years of intense politics fulfilled my taste for being a part of any coterie. And I think a lot of my desire to step away from politics was a desire to read and to become interested in literature. Sort of the beginning of a private time in my life that lasted a very, very long while, that basically involved reading everything that I could get my hands on and writing and not showing it to anybody.
Why didn't you want to show it to anybody?
I felt that I wasn't ready. I felt that even something like taking a writing course in college would be, I don't know, sort of like opening the egg while the chick was still an embryo. It might not go any further than that. I felt that quick encouragement would only keep me frozen at the stage of the development that I was in, and any discouragement whatsoever would be too painful for me because I didn't have an enormous amount of confidence.
Some writers have a monumental experience to write about, like a war that they lived through that can give them material for three or four novels. Others are very absorbed in, say, their religion or their ethnic identity or sexual preference or geography. But you don't seem to have any of that yourself. Do you know? I don't link you up with a school or with an ethnicity or a great moment in American history or a place or anything like that.
No, I don't have that. I mean, and sometimes I wish that I did, but I don't, and you can't will that into being. I mean, I suppose coming from a working class background, I think it gives me a certain angle of vision into the mainstream culture that some writers don't have. But other than that, I think that the thing that I always felt about me was that there was something very common and everyday about me, that my experiences and my take on the world weren't awfully much different from the people who were reading my books. It's just that they had assigned me the job of mulling over their experience. While they did what they did, I was going to do what I did, and I would get to ride around in the cars that they designed or built, and they would read my books, and we would have a kind of division of labor in that way.
Have you ever seen yourself as a political writer? Do you see yourself as a political writer? And I ask that knowing how political you were when you were young.
I don't know if I would call myself a political writer in the way that I think most people think of that label. I think one of the things that has always fascinated me, and I think it's a theme that goes through most of my work, is how do we live together, and what is the difference between what you feel inside, that sort of the anarchy of one's inner life, and the responsibilities to the community as a whole. And I think that's sort of the dialectic that all of my characters have to cope with.
My guest is novelist Scott Spencer, and his new novel, Waking the Dead, has just been published by Knopf. In your last three books, they've been written in a first-person narrative. Do you feel more free with that form, writing in the first person?
All of my books have begun in the third person, and I always feel determined to write them in the third person. I don't know. I think I must have some ancient idea that that's what grown-up serious writers do, is write in the third person. But what has happened in every case so far is that after I lay out the territory of my novel in the third person in the first draft, the person who the novel is really about emerges, and I give the narration over to that character. But again, I've begun a new novel now. It's in the third person. Whether or not 2 years from now when it's printed, it'll be in the third person anymore. I hope it's in the third person.
Why do you feel that it being in the third person is so important?
Well, I think I'm tired of people saying, you know, oh, I like that part when you burn down the house, or I like that part when...
People assume it's autobiographical.
Well, there isn't. And even people who work in the book industries, you know, half assume that it's autobiographical. And since I write about people in such desperate circumstances, I don't know. I feel that it would be also a challenge for me to write a book in the third person. I think that the angle of vision is so much different.
Have you gone through crises, either personal crises or writing crises, where it won't come?
Well, there are times, of course, when it doesn't seem to be there for you. And what I usually do is just not force it, because I hate that bleak sense that comes off a page that's forced. And but I think the greatest crisis I went through was after Endless Love, after having spent so much time writing it, and then realizing, well, it was time to go and write another one now. And I said, I really don't want to. I've just spent basically 10 years alone in a room, you know, writing three books, and I don't want to spend the rest of my life alone in various rooms. And so I just I took off a couple of years and wrote scripts and had a completely different experience as a writer and a different relationship to my life and to people around me. I suddenly had workmates and office politics and gossip, something I'd never had before. All the stuff that people who work in offices find so completely annoying and dispiriting, I was attacking with a relish of a starving person.
But then after all, you wanted to go back to the room and write another novel?
Well, yeah, sure, because that's really what my nature is. But it was nice to have some time away from it.
In your novels, I think you probably write several drafts before you're happy with it. Not being a writer, I can't imagine how depressing it must be to spend maybe a year on a draft and say, no, it's not working, I'm going to throw it out and start all over again. I mean, how do you keep your spirits up when you've decided to start all over again after you've already put a year in or however much time in on a book?
Well, it is hard, and you have to con yourself a little bit. First of all, you can't begin that first draft and calling it the first draft. I always start, you know, I said, I should be typing this right into a, you know, a printing press, because this is it. This is it. I'm the golden guy, and everything I'm saying is going to be just wonderful. And then you come to the point where you realize that you are completely lost, that you've been writing trash for the past 2 months, and that's why you've had a stomachache. And there's no question that it's depressing, but you know that feeling that you have when it's a new semester and you get a brand new notebook and you're not going to make any of the mistakes that you made, and you're not going to like write your girlfriend's name on this one and deface it or anything like that. So I get a brand new notebook and I have that kind of cheerful, clean slate feeling that this time it's going to be different. And this time it should be typed right into the printing press and it's going to, and I can con myself into believing this for every draft.
How do you know finally if you're on the right track or the wrong track?
Well, first of all, the nausea subsides. And I can keep going. That the novel, you know, it's almost like an engine catching. That I can keep going, that I don't have to generate the energy to get going anymore. That it's there, it's sort of waiting for me. And that it begins to spread out and dominate every thought. And I know that I'm fully, fully engaged.
A lot of people know of Endless Love through the movie, and a lot of people think that somehow your book is like the movie, which it isn't, or like the emotions in the song, which it isn't. Did that movie ultimately hurt you in any way because people assume that you must have written the movie, or that your book is exactly like the film? It's like for teens, and it's about very, you know, it's about people who are good looking, and you know.
I don't know. Really, I mean, I don't take my career's temperature like this, and you know, how am I doing? I don't know. I think after having spent so many years without even being able to get a reading on the thermometer, it's not something that I choose to do. I know that this is what the movie did for the book. Gave me readers that I probably never would have had before. And whether these are readers who are going to be interested in me book after book, only time will tell, but I'm grateful for that.
What are the movies and what are some of the books that you feel have really been influential on you?
Well, I think that the books that have been influential for me, I think that the primary influential book was Lolita. And I think that all of Nabokov's work has had a real influence on my sense of what a book can do and what a book has to do. That, you know, he, more than any other writer I can think of, can blend that sort of rhapsody. And I don't want to say this because I'm afraid it'll scare people away from him, but that high art with that very powerful melodramatic sense that keeps you turning pages, that it's not finally about language, it's language that's used as a way of seeing into hearts and into human destinies that you wouldn't have been able to see before. So Lolita and Nabokov as a whole have had a real influence on me.
I'm going to just say something that's kind of irrelevant to what we've been talking about, a little sidebar, I guess. In the sex scenes that you have in your books, you bring into it things that writers usually leave out. And what I'm thinking is menstruation, birth control. These are the things that are usually absent in sexual encounters in books. And I'd like to know if that's intentional, if that's just the way you think, or if you intentionally wanted to work that kind of reality into the scenes. And I should say that your scenes are very mental in a lot of ways too. I mean, you're really kind of involved in the minds of the people who are involved in having sex.
Well, of course, you know, I don't try and figure out, you know, what other people have left out and then put
sure.
that into
he left out the diaphragm. I'll put that in this book.
Right. Yeah, what's up? Wait, has Updike ever done this? I think that you know, in the times I've written about sex, and it's been, you know, long passages about it, that the sex becomes a kind of ritual, a kind of discovery of the other and of something in oneself. And it seems that the avenue to that discovery is in the reality of the body and the body is concentrated on and concentrated on, and then finally gone beyond. And what really does not interest me in sex is all the stuff about power and all the stuff about image and all the stuff, you know, I got her to do this and she's, you know, wondering if I can do this. That stuff, I think, is pretty dull and finally almost ugly. But what does interest me about sex is the, you know, is that possibility for, you know, for nirvana that it offers. And it seems that in order to reach that, you have to go through every bothersome reality that the body presents. And a lot of that is, you know, birth control and menstrual blood and all the other wonderful things that are part of our sexual nature.
In your novels, there's usually someone who's trying to figure out who they are and how they're going to get there. And I wonder at this point in your life how you feel about yours. I mean, do you feel like you're like establishing the kind of life that you meant to have or feel like you were supposed to have or want to have?
Well, I think I've been lucky in that I've been able to do a lot of what I wanted to do. But I don't know, maybe it's just a nature or maybe it's just a habit of thought, but I don't think there's a 2 months go by without me stopping and saying, what am I doing with my life? I mean, I can't believe that this is really what it is.
What do you think you should be doing?
When you have those moments of doubt. It's usually the opposite of what I'm doing at the moment. I suppose that, you know, I'm living in the country. Gee, don't you think I should be living in the city? There's a... I suppose one of the things that interests me about fate is that, you know, is the opportunity that it affords us to be lifted out of that kind of questioning and having to deal with something larger than ourselves.
So you believe in fate?
I don't know if I believe in fate with a capital F. I don't go to seances or read tea leaves, but I believe that, you know, that circumstance can take us to places that we couldn't have imagined.
That was writer Scott Spencer, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Scott Spencer's novels include Preservation Hall, Endless Love, and his latest, Waking the Dead, which is published by Knopf. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Orji Voblaitis. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.